after that, the attacks got much worse. And that's what sort of kills me about this idea of the purple fingers being the symbol of freedom for the Iraqi people. Because the reason why people's fingers had to be dyed with indelible ink is because Paul Bremer never conducted the census. That is how weak their commitment to democracy was, even though, as I said, it was the first item on the agenda of the Baghdad City Council. And even though Iraq's Census Bureau told him that they were fully capable of doing a census in time to have the elections, they just never did it. With all the billions that they had to spend in Iraq, they never spent a cent conducting a census. So when the elections finally happened, the only way to make sure people didn't vote twice because there were no voter rolls was to dye people's fingers blue. But when you dye people's fingers blue in a country as dangerous as Iraq, it means that when people go home to their neighborhoods, they're marked, they're vulnerable to retaliation. I'm sure these are the first elections in history where the candidates were anonymous because they were worried about their security, but the voters were marked. Now, this brings me to this second idea of what the elections were for, which is showing that Iraqis are willing to stand up to terror. Because there's absolutely no doubt that Iraqis took their lives in their hands when they went to the polls. There were 175 attacks on that single day. There are 50 to 60 attacks on any given day in Iraq. But the reason the country is as treacherous as it is a direct result of these policies. Hussein Kuba, who's an Iraqi industrialist, described the Iraqi resistance as alternative employment. That first decision that Paul Bremer made to lay off Iraq's entire army but let them keep their guns did more than any other to feed the rise of the armed resistance. But it continued to be fed as foreign workers came in and took Iraqi jobs, as unemployment soared. And it was also the broken promises about civil liberties, about freedom. Fallujah has become equated with the most violent of the Iraqi resistance. And we're often told that that Fallujah is filled with ex-Baathists and foreign fighters. And you would have the impression that they have been fighting the occupation from the start, but in fact, they didn't fight the occupation from the start. Fallujah was peaceful for the first month after the invasion. But they were against the presence of US soldiers in their communities. And the Marines in Fallujah did something very strange, which is they set up a military base in the school. And the Fallujans were very upset about this because their children couldn't use the school, they couldn't study. So they decided to use some of their newfound freedoms, and they decided to have a protest. On April 28th, a group of Iraqi parents and teachers and children staged a demonstration where they marched up to the US military base at the school and they asked them to leave. The way the US soldiers reacted is they opened fire on the demonstration and they killed 13 people and they wounded 75 others. A couple of days later, they had a demonstration against these killings and two more people were killed. The next day was May 1, the day that George Bush declared the end to major combat, the day he said, mission accomplished. In Fallujah, which had been a peaceful city until then, the combat had only just begun because it was only after those protests, only after people lost faith in nonviolent action, that you started to see the first violent attacks. There are hundreds of similar stories in Iraq of people losing faith in democracy, one bullet at a time, losing faith that US troops were in fact there as liberators and seeing them as brutal occupiers. The single greatest contributor to violence in Iraq is not foreign fighters and it's not religious fundamentalists, though there are some there. It is the occupation itself. by refusing and refusing and refusing to end. That is what feeds the violence. So yes, on January 30th, Iraqis stood up to terror. But thanks to these policies, thanks to this systematic suppression of democracy, they have to stand up to terror every day. The first night I was in Baghdad, the hotel down the street from me was blown up, the Mount Lebanon Hotel. And it was just the most incredible blast imaginable. The whole sky was filled with lava, and it shattered the windows of our hotel and filled it with debris. It was this incredible impact. This was a hotel that was filled with a lot of independent journalists and NGO types, and we all raced down to the lobby of our hotel. And there were all these people milling around, and the television was on. So we went to the television because we wanted to find out, even though it only happened a block away, we thought we could see on television how big the blast was and what had actually happened. But the hotel staff wasn't watching Al Jazeera, they were watching football, because this happens all the time. And the next day, most of us checked out of this hotel because it had no security. And as I was checking out, the hotel proprietor said, "You're afraid of bombs?" I used to be afraid of bombs. Valium in liquid form is sold everywhere on the streets of Baghdad. It is the only thing that gets people through the day. So Iraqis stand up to terror. And yes, it's courageous, but it's not a choice. It's a brutal, everyday fact of life. And regular people in Iraq don't get body armor, and they aren't protected by blast walls. So they have to stand up to terror, to go to schools, to go to the market, to go to the mosque. So it seems like an obscenity to me to hear George Bush celebrate the courage of the Iraqi people when it's his policies that led directly to the spread of this violence. I'm just going to skip ahead here because I don't want to keep you here all night. All right. All right. Well, it's sometimes the reason why I'm trying to tell this as a story is because when you watch it from here, I think it often seems really incomprehensible. There's all these twists and turns, all these plan A's and plan B's and plan C's and plan D's, and we must be at plan Q by now. But if you pay attention, there is one theme that remains constant in all of these decisions. And that theme is that for this government, a simple majority of Iraqis must not be allowed to govern Iraq. That is the theme of all these twists and turns. Because if they had that power, as I've said, the objectives of the war would not be reached. There would not be the permanent military bases. There wouldn't be the privatized oil. There wouldn't be the model free trade zone, the corporate utopia. And don't let these latest elections fool you, because that is still the plan, Plan Q, or whatever we're at. Because what Iraqis have said again and again to pollsters and at the polls is that what they want for their country is antithetical to what the Bush administration wants for Iraq. Over the past 8 months, while Iraq has been ruled by the puppet regime of Iyad Alawi, which is the result of that refusal to hold elections right away, they've been very, very busy. There's been a slew of contracts and backroom deals that have been negotiated and signed to make sure that Iraqis never have the power to threaten those interests and goals. That's what this whole interim period has been about. And I want to tell you what I mean by that. Here are a few other excerpts from the platform of the winning party in Iraq's recent elections, the United Iraqi Alliance. In addition to demanding troop withdrawal, they also are calling for adopting a social security system under which the state guarantees a job for every fit Iraqi. Full employment. They are calling for the state to offer facilities for Iraqis to build their homes, to take care